sayings, as well as traditional performances like Chuanju or Sichuan opera and other classical Chinese theatrical arts. In addition to that, I am deeply interested in themes related to governance, development, and the revival of Chinese culture. That's why many of my works have been able to document different historical periods in China. Each piece, in its own way, reflects the themes and characteristics of its respective era.
每一个不同的这个时期的一些题材。
Right. Now I want to discuss, like, when it comes to international co-productions. Imagine, you talked about the proximity of the cultures of Iran and China. These are two countries that both have long history of traditions, so that is easier to work with that kind of culture. The other thing I want to know, imagine that you're kind of offered to make a co-production with a country that doesn't necessarily have that same proximity of culture with China. How would you approach finding the common grounds with a totally new and different culture?
Actually, the human heart is like a peach. Hearts connect with one another. Even if I don't understand your language and you don't understand mine, it's enough for our hearts to be in sync, for our spirits to connect, and for our eyes to speak to each other. I believe that when that happens, all problems can be resolved. For example, when I was working with the Iranian team during the filming process, we faced exactly these kinds of challenges, like language barriers, cultural differences, different working styles and approaches. But in the end, after just a short period of time, we were able to collaborate, communicate, write the script together, and complete our designs. There were no problems, just shared purpose.
Right. And how do you hope your films and productions kind of help the global audience to have a better understanding of China?
In essence, philosophy pays the deepest attention to the fundamental questions of human existence. Our documentaries, whether they explore major themes, embrace realism, or take on other forms, are all centered around human experiences. I believe there's a close connection between these elements, and they can strengthen and support one another. I often draw on philosophical thinking throughout the creative process when reviewing a script, reflecting on life, or evaluating my films and my work. Through different philosophies and ways of thinking, people gradually strive for a better life and more beautiful creations. To me, documentary film, philosophy, and human life should coexist. They're all present with us, not far away as they may seem, but in fact very close.
Right. Well, Mr. Zhang, I know that you are also a university professor, and you, one of the fields that you teach in university is philosophy, if I'm right. I want to know, what is your philosophical approach to documentary filmmaking and cinema in general?
That's a great question. I believe that whether on a global scale or within individual countries, everyone hopes for peace. The world is like a family, and just like in any family, people wish for peace. Of course, even within families, there are disagreements and conflicts between spouses, children, or parents. Similarly, at the level of nations and the world as a whole, misunderstandings and disputes are natural and unavoidable. But I believe, deep down, people truly desire peace. Even in places like the United States, I'm convinced that over time, a and through the efforts of each of us, including those working in digital media, film and documentary, we can move closer to peace. And I believe art can play a powerful role in that journey.
Right. My other question regarding culture and international situation in cinema is that, well, we are living in a world of turmoil and political ups and downs nowadays, to say the least, of course. But the situation that we have in the Middle East, the situation in Gaza and Palestine, and also, of course, with Donald Trump in office at the US and his tariffs and the tariff war with China. How do you think art, culture, can make a difference and can kind of bring the cultures together a little bit more in order to create a better balance in world affairs and change this situation for the better?
Making a documentary is incredibly challenging, whether you're the director, the cinematographer, or the host. It's demanding work, and it doesn't bring in much income. It often takes a long time, sometimes a month, 2 months, a year, 2 years, or even 10 years. Many documentary filmmakers, myself included, have lived modest and challenging lives. Securing enough funding and financial support is extremely hard. And beyond that, many people struggle to keep going because even the early stages of finding resources for a documentary are a major challenge. That's the biggest obstacle documentary filmmakers face.
Of course, one of the most important questions in documentary cinema is the question of funding, which is kind of the thing that guarantees sustainability of a documentary maker's career. How do you fund your projects?
As a filmmaker and documentarian, I often have a very low income. Many times I've had to fund projects out of my own pocket. And I've even borrowed money from my spouse on occasion, unlike some directors who might earn millions from a single film. Our earnings are quite modest. Still, choosing my own path matters deeply to me. I could have made films that were more commercially successful, but I prefer to work on projects that may not generate much income, because the subjects and communities I focus on deserve the attention of a responsible and committed director.
Right. Well, Mr. Zhang, you're right now a jury member at the Soap Media Festival, of course, the third edition of it. How do you think necessary are such occasions and such festivals for documentary cinema, and especially certain types of documentary cinema that are being screened and taken care of and supported with this festival?
This was my first time visiting Iran and Tehran and participating in the Soap Media Festival. Before traveling from China, I went to the Iranian embassy there and met with the cultural attaché, who gave me detailed information about the festival and the related international news. During the events, I also served as a jury member and watched many works. When I arrived in Iran, I was welcomed with such warmth and sincerity. It felt just like being greeted by family. From the very first day through to the opening ceremony, the team's meticulous planning and attention to detail truly impressed me and left a lasting impact. In my opinion, the Soap Festival has three key strengths that highlight its importance. First, its international scope, with participants from dozens of countries, filmmakers, producers, and cinema professionals all gathered in Tehran, and everyone seemed genuinely happy and satisfied. Second, the selection of topics. The festival focuses on clear and meaningful themes. For example, this year it featured a special section on Palestine, which was very well done. And third is growth and outreach. I hope the festival can expand its activities in China and attract more attention from Chinese audiences and the global community, so it can evolve into an even more prominent international platform.
Right. Well, I don't know if you've started your filmmaking career with analog cinema and then moved on to digital, but I want to, generally speaking, know your opinion on the role of technology, new technology, on cinema, the kind of change it has brought with it to these documentary type of cinema.
That's a really good question. In fact, many TV networks in China no longer use human robots. Most of them now rely on robotic presenters. Even for Chinese hosts themselves, the job has become increasingly challenging. In our creative team, we often use cutting-edge AI technologies, including both domestic and international software, even some that are available in Iran. Now, we have a large number of virtual hosts and digital humans. In my creative work, for example, when designing a closed scene or a set, we used to have to build and execute everything manually. It used to take 2 to 3 months, sometimes even half a month at best. But now, it can be done in about a week. In the visual projects I'm currently working on, the entire film is ready even before shooting begins. Cinematographers can preview camera positions, actors can see how their performances will look, and the set design is already complete. As I've said before, I really love technology, and I believe the future belongs to artificial intelligence. Of course, AI may not yet be able to fully replace hosts or every profession, but I hope young creators will explore and experiment with it. This year in China, the government officially approved the screening of AI-generated films, which shows how seriously China is embracing this technology and allowing it to play a major role in cinema. Even in documentary and short film production, the same applies. At this year's festival, I saw some works that seemed to be made with AI, but in some cases, it's still difficult to judge certain aspects clearly.
Right. And to complete that, of course, imagine you're busy making a documentary film, and then somebody, one of the crew members of your staff, comes and just shoots a part of it with a mobile phone, and you have to take like 3 months to edit and add narration and everything, but the guy in your team can post that small clip, that very short clip, on Instagram, on another social media platform in a matter of seconds. Does it kind of make social media more important, or does it kind of get some of the effect of cinema and documentary from it?
In this era of technological advancement and artificial intelligence, many tools like mobile phones have become incredibly useful. These days, we can often create an entire film using just the camera on our phone. In China, we frequently hold showcases and workshops focused on mobile filmmaking. Personally, I often shoot short videos on set using my phone. Everyone knows that short videos are extremely influential in China, and they've made a significant impact globally as well. So, if you're passionate about visuals and filmmaking, I truly believe that today you can absolutely create a short film or even a documentary using just a mobile phone. In fact, from what I experienced in this year's festival entries, I guess many of those films were shot on phones.
Right. What advice would you give to young, aspiring documentary filmmakers?
Well, I truly believe that young filmmakers should start with what's around them, with the people and their lives, and the subjects close to their everyday experiences. They should focus on familiar environments and familiar events. As you mentioned, using a mobile phone or working within the format of a short film is a great way to begin creating. In this process, you have to keep experimenting. You have to allow yourself to fail and move forward step by step. In the end, all you really need is love, vision, and hope. I believe that your dreams will eventually come true. You shouldn't give up in the face of hardship, and you shouldn't be afraid to fall. You just have to keep going.
Right, and are there any stories that you dream of making and still haven't had the chance yet?
Yes, I do. For example, I'm really interested in focusing on police and crime genres in filmmaking. It's an area I'd love to explore more deeply and understand better. But so far, I haven't had the time or the opportunity to connect with it or gain hands-on experience. I've also always been curious about many topics related to Iran, subjects I'd like to learn about and discover, but I haven't yet had the chance to dive into them.
Right. Well, Mr. Zhang Zhong, it's a pleasure to have you on this program. As we approach the end of the show, of course, we have a few moments when you talk directly to our audience. Our audience will momentarily become yours, so feel free to share whatever you want with your audience now.
Hello everyone, I'm Shang Zhong, a filmmaker from China. This is my first time visiting Iran, and I've come to Tehran to participate in the Sub International Media Festival. I'm truly happy and honored to greet you all here. I wish you health and success in everything you do. And if the opportunity arises in the future, I warmly invite all of you to visit China. I'll be waiting for you in Beijing.
Mr. Zhang Zhong, once again, thank you so much for taking the time and coming to Seoul. And thank you guys for staying with us on another conversation. This is Seoul. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Batman.
a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Asma. I have the honor to be your host once more, and you are listening to Muslim Lady. This is the cozy corner for all the ladies out there. Wherever you are, I hope you're doing just well. So, as usual, we have our very dear lady to help us with the insights, and she is Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming here.
I am Tarfadlan Zainab Askari. I'm actually from Kashmir, and I've been studying Hausa here for the last 10 years, and I'm also authoring one or two books on Muslim Lady.
So there comes the very common topic of women's financial independence. I have been working on myself so hard, getting into different academic environments, like trying so hard. So now I want to flourish something out of whatever I've learned. So I think I can get into different jobs, like I can do different responsibilities and share a part in my society, like to help my society flourish.
Women's independence has certain advantages and certain disadvantages.
Oh, let's start with disadvantages.
All right, we can start with the disadvantages. Basically, I think the modern education and economic pressures have pushed us as women into the workforce. It's not necessarily always the motivation behind it being financial. It's a psychological fulfillment. It's more about independence, more about social contribution, as you already talked about. But the disadvantages, I think it's energy draining and reduced family attention. Like I would say, my personal experiences, working women, when they often return home, they're more mentally and physically exhausted, limiting the time and energy available for the spouses and their children. So that's one. And also there's it also brings sometimes, you know, double burden, like work plus housework, because most men do not share the household duties sufficiently like Imam Ali alayhi salam would do, which causes women to shoulder both the workloads, and this strain can lead to tension, fatigue, and also the conflicts, you know. So because she is single-handedly doing also the outside work and also the inside work. So it's a double burden sometimes. And challenges in the childcare do occur when we are independent, because work demands more focus, and it conflicts with parenting responsibilities, which creates constant worry about time, presence, and influence on children.
Just as a side note to your nice explanation of the disadvantages, I think that all these disadvantages that you were talking, they arise when the husband is not helping.
Yeah,
like if she's single, there's no problem in energy drain and not being able to devote enough of time for herself.
If you're doing that before marriage, like when you do not have much family responsibilities, that's okay. That's
So, and then when the responsibilities come,
because it also has its own advantages. It's not like it does not have advantages at all. So, but yeah, it does have.
So for disadvantages, I have some suggestions. Like if the husband can lend a helping hand,
like
a more active.
I said try to be like Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Exactly. So I guess the disadvantages would be lowered, reduced, and some sort of neutralized.
Yeah.
If the husband shares a very, lends actually a very active helping hand meanwhile.
Yeah, I would say especially it becomes easy for independent, to have that independence when you are not into the marital relationship, mm-hmm. when you are single, it's more easy and you don't have really much burdens, you don't have childcare, things like that. You can contribute to society and use your skills.
I have this very basic question. I told you that this discussion has got a very long history.
Yeah.
Why we don't always talk about, okay, men wants this and want that. It's always about women. Like women, they strive for independence. Women want this and they want that. And they have this longing and that longing. So it starts from somewhere.
Yeah.
So where has this discussion of women longing to be financially independent started? We go for a break and then we come back to see what is your answer.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear ladies. This is your cozy corner, and Sister Zainab is here with us. I'm Asma, and you're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm very happy to be here with Sister Zainab and with you, of course, because we're sharing something which is, I guess, very interesting and very common. And everybody, even right now in 21st century, is talking about it. It's still an ongoing debate of, okay, whether it is good or not for women to be financially independent. And I think it's not about is it good or bad as much as it is about the side effects, which Sister Zainab was just talking about them. Like, they start to talk about it when they see the family disintegrations, like when a woman is working so hard outside her home. She definitely is not going to be able to be an active participant in the house, to be a caring mother and to be a caring, perhaps, wife. So that debate starts from there. Yet, if the husband gets actively engaged in the process of taking care of the home and of the family, then these questions are not going to pop up into anyone's mind at all.
Yeah, and also, like, I think there are cultural things that bring these discussions into, like, for example, in many cultures it's said that women are only meant to be inside the home. And
yeah, that's
right
where it started.
Exactly, because that's a cultural thing. It has got nothing to do with Islam. For example, in Islam we are said that, if, for example, in Surah Nisa, it's stated that all and women shall have a share of what they have earned. So God has deemed women's earning and employment permissible and has described her as the rightful owner of the income from her own labor.
Yeah.
Same is not for the men. Like, men have to provide sustenance
to
their family.
He is the provider.
But a woman, she can earn here, according to this verse, and her earnings are her own. So, like, see, Islam gives us more, I would say, freedom and right. So women's employment, especially in the contemporary era, is among the debated issues. We know that, especially in the Islamic societies as well. Yet Islam is something that emphasizes the dignity of women and within the ethical boundaries. That's what's important in Islam, and deems their social participation as legitimate. I would say, for example, when I was living in two cultures, like I lived in Kashmir, I lived in Iran. And the best thing I felt in Iran was during my delivery time, when the entire workforce in the hospital was all women.
Yeah.
And I felt so comfortable, uh-huh. so grateful to God that he kept me in this situation in a country where I had to face no men in this situation, which is really hard for women, you know.
Yeah.
So alhamdulillah, we had that workforce. So that way, when women come and contribute to the society,
exactly.
It is, I think, the need of the time, because in our religion, it's not permissible. As long as, you know, female doctors are available, you're not permissible.
That woman did
yeah.
not have that yearning and longing to get more education and to be actively engaged in societal issues, she would have never been a doctor.
Exactly.
And women would have been in need of male doctors, which is actually
Which is so much there.
Disconcerting,
in Kashmir,
actually.
Yeah,
it's very disconcerting, and women do not like that. Like, for women, it's tough. It's not easy to go for a male doctor, for a male. I don't know. When there is a woman, it's easier to go for a woman.
Right. I saw in the same hospital people traveling from Iraq and other places, like from the Muslim countries, and
just
to get treated by women in Iran.
So it's a blessing.
It is a blessing.
It is a blessing.
Because we do need such gynees. We do need women as gynees in the society.
Yeah, and these women are actually diamonds. Like, they shine like a diamond in all the societies, in all the Muslim societies, because they're just helping the women not to be in need of male doctors, male teachers, like, you know, because then the process of learning, the process of getting healed, all the processes that women are in need of is going to be facilitated and pretty much easier.
Exactly.
Now, you know, there's also another myth. They say that if a woman gets a financial independence, then she wouldn't be interested in marriage anymore.
That's, again, what kind of culture she's been exposed to. But if we talk about Quran again here, like in verses of Surah Jumu'ah, in verses of Surah Al-Mulk, we have that all people, both men and women, are invited to seek God's bounty. So what is this culture going to stop me from? What are these myths? Why are these myths going to stop me from taking the God's bounty when God himself is inviting me, both men and women? You know, he invites us to seek that bounty. So earning income and participating in the economic sphere are among the instances of seeking a divine bounty. So also in Surah Qasas, we have, when it recounts the story of Prophet Moses and the daughters of Shu'aib, it provides us evidence for the permissibility of women working outside the home. Likewise, the narrative of Queen Bilqis in the Surah Naml, It offers another example affirming women's capacity for leadership and participation in public affairs. And so many things, like we saw Lady Khadija salam alayha as a business tycoon. What is really important is to be modest, dress modest.
And to consider God.
I think you should never, ever, ignore God, even in the... Like, for example, as Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, he would wake up early in the morning and he would every day make this dua. Oh God, do not leave me on my own self, like Prophet, with that magnanimity, with that compassion, with that kindness, with that state of prophethood. He says to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, do not leave me on my own state, for a blink of an eye. So who are we? Like, we should... consider God always in all and every spheres of our lives.
Exactly.
So,
and you mentioned something very important. Since women are very respected in our religion, her dignity is very important. So
yeah, and a woman can take care of, if a woman is sure that she can take care of this in an environment, then she should go ahead. But you know, sometimes, unfortunately, I would like to talk about it here, we fall into practical polytheism head when we go into the working environment as women. I would say how, for example, they don't have those criteria and rules for men what they have for women. For example, I don't know, in many of the companies you see outside, I know this is not happening in Iran, but if you go out of Iran, if you see in our countries, unfortunately, on our newspapers, the rules are written. Like, if you come to the airline company or if you come to any other company, you should not wait more than this. Your weight should not be more than this. What has my weight got to do with my skills? You know, how is my weight going to interfere with my skills? So all those things, like, sometimes we agree to the rules and responsibilities of a company and we ignore the commands of God here. That's how we fall into practical polytheism, because now others' commands and rules are becoming a priority.
So the important things are, again, we come back to this point of considering God in every single step you take.
Exactly.
Being a man or woman, that does not differ. But since we're talking to women and we're addressing Muslim ladies, the thing that matters, be it like if you want to be financially independent, if you want to go for education, the only thing that matters is that you take care of your dignity and you consider God.
The last point I would like to add here is that even if you never say that I was in a situation, I was forced to work, I was in need, even if you are desperately in need, but there are grounds available to fall into sins, or you can't be modest and you have to go against the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I would suggest leave it, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala promises. His promises are true. He promises in Surah Talaq, like, if you leave anything for me, you can't imagine where from I will provide your sustenance.
Yeah, so we do believe that ladies are the great engine of the entire world. So without them, there wouldn't be any motherhood, and without them, there wouldn't be any color in this world. So thank you for all the mothers out there. Thank you for all the working ladies out there, for all the women who have shared a great part in society with their education, with all the knowledge they're sharing. And yeah, just keep it up. So this was all for today. Until another episode. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and
English Radio.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. In total, 25 prophets are mentioned in the Holy Quran in different chapters. Prophet Moses, or Musa in Arabic, peace be upon him, is mentioned 136 times in the Holy Quran, making him the most mentioned prophet of all in the Holy Book of Allah. The literal meaning of the word Quran is the which is being read. The word Quran is repeated 70 times in the Book of Allah itself. The month of Ramadan is the only month of the year mentioned in Quran in verse 185 of chapter Al-Baqarah, or second chapter. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have Islamic Laws. The program focuses on Islamic laws and adopts a practical approach to the subject. Next up will be our varied radio productions feature again. Stay with us for this hour.
Welcome to another edition of Face to Face. My name is Dieter Reinisch, and you're joining us today from the UN headquarters in Vienna. With me today is the Deputy Foreign Minister of Belarus, Igor Segreta. Igor Segreta has been here in Vienna for the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE and for a meeting with the IAEA Director General, Raffaele Grossi. Mr. Segreta, you just came from a meeting with IAEA Director General Raffaele Grossi. What was the purpose of your meeting? What was on the agenda?
You know, each and every time I'm visiting Vienna, I'm looking for new contacts. I'm visiting our partners and friends. We strictly cooperate, and the agency, Atomic International Atomic Agency, is one of our key partners. Because, as you might know, we built, we created a new industry. We've built a nuclear power plant, and we did that from the start, from the getting the so to say decision to build the new nuclear power plant till the finishing of its and bringing it into action, into exploitation. We've been relying, and we will looking for assistance of International Atomic Energy Agency, and we're very helpful for them for their very professional and very timely assistance.
You just mentioned it. You are expanding your existing nuclear power plant. You are recently, President Lukashenko announced to build a third unit. Why did Belarus decide to put more, such a large focus on peaceful nuclear energy?
Well, it's natural, I think. As soon as we see the energy consumption growing, we had to modernize our generation capacities. So we've seen the efficiency and the outcome of the nuclear power plant, modern technology, the highest level of security. You know, for Belarus, we are very vulnerable in that sense, because we've had a tragedy in 1986 in Chernobyl, and Belarus was severely contaminated by the radiation after that. So for some years, we had to persuade people that peaceful and very modern and very secure atomic energy can bring substantial results for the economy. As I mentioned, the energy consumption is growing each and every year. People, regular citizens, they buy more and more electrical cars, more and more public transportation means is driven by the electricity. We started developing the mining capacities for cryptocurrency, and we're looking for the data center creation. The Belarus is a developed IT country that puts a lot of attention to that sector. Well, that's why we see the trend, and we follow it. Just
you mentioned the constructive cooperation with the IAEA in regards to peaceful nuclear energy, but at the same time we've witnessed, in particular the last 2 years, heated debates here in this building, here in Vienna, at the Board of Governors meetings, at the General Conference of the IAEA, in relation to ongoing armed conflicts around the world, both in Middle East, West Asia, and in Eastern Europe. Two of your neighboring countries, Russia and Ukraine, are at war at the moment. And there is debate on security of nuclear plants in Ukraine, also in the Kursk region. There are regular attacks in the vicinity of these nuclear plants. How do you see the role of the IAEA in these conflicts?
IAEA has the highest ever reputation in that sphere, and represents a big majority of countries that have the atomic capacities on their territory, and they know that security in that sphere is crucial. So in the ongoing conflict, I think, and you've heard that on the conference, President suggested that we should introduce a ban for the attacks on critical infrastructure objects, and we should protect them properly, and we should mobilize the support of the international community. Meaning the protection, I meant also the ban for imposing sanctions on the industries, countries that utilize the atomic energy, because that might bring to some shortages of spare parts or some technologies that are crucially sufficient and necessary for providing the security. So definitely, those those capacities, atomic capacities, should be duly protected, and because the explosion on them could bring to the could easily bring to the situation that we've had on the Chernobyl reactor in 1986 and in any other countries, and this could contaminate vast territories, big territories in Europe. So for our own security, we should do a lot and persuade the international community, and the International Atomic Agency could do a good job in that, persuading their members to refrain from attacking the NPPs.
Which is actually the statute of the IAEA, but still in June, such attacks happened. The US and Israel attacked Iranian sites, nuclear sites. In reaction to that, unfortunately, Director General Grossi refused to condemn these attacks. And at the General Conference in September, a resolution had been tabled by Russia, China, and Iran, and also supported by your country, Belarus, to refrain from these attacks. How do you see the situation now that even in the 21st century, it is still necessary to table a motion that says we are against attacks on peaceful nuclear facilities?
I think that we are still a little bit far from getting the long-standing solution for that. But I can only confirm that Belarus will support each and every effort that will bring more protection, more security, and more peace, even if there is some dispute or conflict appears. We were following attentively. I think many people, many politicians in our region and outside were worried about the situation which took place in Iran. And I think that exactly not by weapons, not by means of military forces, any obstacles, any disputes could be solved. This is the job of the international employees, international agencies, politicians and diplomats. And that's what we're interested to do. We do believe in a classical diplomacy without fakes, without assaults, attacks on each other. That's what we see now on the OEC premises in the United Nations. People sometimes blame secretariats of these organizations for not providing a proper assistance or just infrastructure or getting some events which would suit them. But, you know, I would like to draw your attention that the secretariats, they just serve the countries. And the atmosphere which is now in Vienna, in Geneva, in New York, and in other European and world capitals is just like this, like the countries are representing themselves on these sites. So we have to start, and we've talked about that with Director General of the Atomic Agency, that we do believe that politicians from countries active in that sphere, in the sphere of security, in atomic energy, in the conflict settlement, they will be more polite and they will be more constructive in discussing modern challenges.
And you just mentioned the OSCE. That was, so to say, the second purpose of your visit to Vienna, the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE that took place here in Vienna this week. And I followed the conference very closely. I listened to the speeches over the past 2 days, and listening to the speeches, the constant attacks both on Belarus and Russia from every single minister, delegate, and representative. One might wonder, why are you attending the OSCE conference in such an atmosphere?
Because we do believe in the spirit of Helsinki. We believe in the force of real classical diplomacy. We do believe in the future of this organization, which can be a very effective instrument in for the conflict settlement. That's what it has been designed for. You're absolutely right. What we see in Hofburg recent years, is just the throwing to each other the national statements, but. Unlike many other countries from Europe and other regions, we each and every time try to persuade our partners try to find the solutions, try to mobilize the support, try to find the not politically biased topics that we could discuss in smaller groups, in a some formats that are not non-discriminatory for other participants. And I think what we are now lacking at the OSCE premises is the talks about the participation of Russia and security for Russia. Because what has started in Ukraine, it was the lack of security for Russia itself, with the NATO expansion, with the collapse of Soviet Union, with the collapse of the international architecture, with the collapse of that spirit of Helsinki that brought people from different countries with different views to the same table, which finalized with the final act, Helsinki Final Act in 1975. So I do believe in the power and force of diplomacy, and I hope we will shortly bring to an end to that conflict, and we will restore the trust and enhance the confidence building measures.
But as I said, listening to the speech and also following other international organizations, one becomes very pessimistic that this approach is even possible. Instead of what you said, the spirit of Helsinki in 1975, the idea of closing the gap between different blocs, presenting a space for dialogue, now we see a clear split in all international organizations, the introductions of sanctions against states, just like your state, but also other states, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and the so-called sanctions regime from the West is tightening. How you assess, in general, the Eurasian security architecture at the moment?
Well, I think that we should bring the security issues in a broader context than Europe itself. We should expand it to the whole continent, Eurasian continent, and that's what we are doing regularly in Minsk since already 3 years. The newest edition of the conference took place in October, end of October in Minsk, and it every year it gathers more and more participants. We enhance the level of political participants from different countries, and we try to attract as many attention as we can, transforming this event to the unlike-minded event. We are not seeking support and looking only for our friends. We are also inviting those who will not support us, but they will understand our motivation, our efforts, and will someday they will bring some also support and income to that format. I do agree with you that the situation is far from ideal, from being too peaceful, but if we stop talking, if we close the doors, we will bring the world and the region to the war, the global war, or to the full-scale war in the region. That's what we don't want to do. And our intention is not to make everyone agree with us. The intention was to make everyone understand what we mean, and we could also understand the intentions of the other side. That brings, because the war is being often starts when people don't talk to each other and they don't understand each other. This misunderstanding it enhances the level of conflict potential. Conference is a good format. You participated in that, and I think you felt the atmosphere of Minsk spirit, so to say. And we will continue. We are not substituting OSCE in any case. OSCE is an international organization where we could do the three traditional baskets, our cooperation, and the conference is the awareness building, is the spreading of information, and gaining support from countries that are worried by the problems in Eurasian security. Well, you've seen the number of participants from big Eurasia, from different countries, from different analytics reviewers and specialists in international relations. I like this atmosphere we've created, and I do believe that we will go further, because it has become an annual event in Minsk.
By strengthening Eurasian security at the same time, when you look at the Western media, the Western politicians, they accuse Belarus of undermining European security. Very often you hear this example of using migrants to undermine Western European security. What do you say to this argument?
Well, we don't use anyone. Migrants are trying to cross the border illegally via our territory because they are desperate about the situation in their countries, in their countries of origin. And they use our territory to get to a better life. But what they see on the border, they see the cruel pushbacks, they see the unwelcome approach from the authorities of the neighboring countries. They don't see any even procedures, refugees procedures or asylum seekers procedures. They don't see the, and they, you know, are being disappointed, and we see less and less those poor people on our borders. We try to persuade our partners that we should return to the format of building shelters for those people. We should do something to improve situations in their countries of origin, and Belarus is very much engaged in that process. You've noticed probably the visits of our president, of our prime minister, our minister of foreign affairs to Asian countries, to African countries, where we create jobs, where we supply our technologies and equipment, and that brings more trust, more confidence, and we are happy that our turnover is increasing in food and products and machinery and so on. So I think that the illegal migration is a problem that we could combat on together. And just throwing the claims on some countries, that doesn't help to change the situation for the best. So we call upon international community and our neighbors and countries of origin of those migrants to sit and see together what could be done in, to improve the situation. Commenting your remarks on the Eurasian security, I would like to know that the main problem mostly lays that some parties want to win, but